Sound Podcast. I'm Andrew McGregor, and with each installation of this podcast, we're going to explore the world of spirituality, what it means to be alive, and how is it that we can bring our spiritual selves, tarot, meditation, religious or spiritual practices, into our daily lives. Please check out all of our episodes at thehermitslamp.com/podcasts, or you can search The Hermit's Lamp in podcasts on iTunes and download them all directly that way. I'd also like to invite you to take a journey with yourself and the tarot cards this summer. I'm running a 6-week workshop available in person in Toronto through live participation in video, and I'd also like to take a moment to invite you to check out a class that I'm running this summer called Tarot for Yourself, a 6-week workshop on reading the cards for yourself as a profound exploration practice, available any which way you like, streaming video, live internet participation, or in person here in Toronto. This course will certainly bring you closer to yourself and to the cards, and you can check it out at thehermitslamp.com/4U. That's 4 and the letter U. So welcome back to another episode of the Hermit's Lamp podcast. I'm here with Melissa Lucia, and we're going to talk today about Melissa's new edition of her deck, the Oracle of Initiation. And, we're going to chat about spirits and all sorts of fun kind of stuff, as well as the ways in which things like crowdsourcing and some of these other new technologies in the world are coming out are impacting the spiritual realms. So, Melissa, why don't you tell people who don't know who you are just a little bit about yourself?
Hi, lovely to be here with you. I'm Melissa Lucia, and I'm an artist, and I love to have adventures. Grew up in a family of artists, and so there's always been this rebellious, maverick feel to my family, and I've continued that in my own way. I've created the Oracle of Initiation, which is a deck that took me 6 years to complete with a full book, and that deck came out of an initiatory process that I went through after my husband had died. And I went on a 7-year vision quest, and I fell in love with horses, and I moved from the Pacific Northwest to the desert Southwest, a completely different climate, and ended up doing this oracle deck that, to me, it's from the dream time. And there were actually many literal dreams that brought the deck forth. And so I'm traveling around in the world, seeing and finding magic where it is.
Well, and speaking of dreams, I mean, that's kind of why we're doing this conversation today, right? Because you had a dream, and that led to us meeting and talking.
Yes. Well, I had a dream about you and Carrie Paris, another tarot maven, one of my favorite people, and then Eric Dunn, who has done the Illuminati tarot. And we were all together in a back room, and there were these different tarot decks that were there. And I was talking to Carrie about some things, and I introduced myself to you. And I couldn't remember the name of my deck for a moment, which was really interesting. And something that I haven't told you yet, actually, but I'll tell you right now, I don't know if you've ever considered doing an Orisha deck or if you have done an Orisha deck. But I've now had two dreams about you and I connecting around an Orisha deck. So the dreams keep coming, and I actually moved to the desert Southwest because I had 5 potent dreams that called me to Red Earth. And that's how my life tends to work, is that the dreams are so beautiful, and it's the spirit world coming into the mundane world. It's the threshold between them. And it's as if every night any of us can get the most beautiful or sometimes difficult but interesting movie that we've ever experienced. And to me, it's direct messages from the spirits. And so I write them down and I pay attention to them, and I don't always understand them, but so you've shown up in my dreams quite a few times now, my dear.
I've been busy, eh? I've been busy.
You've been very busy.
Yeah, well, I certainly I certainly get a lot from my dreams, you know, and I definitely deliberately cultivate answers in my dreams. And, you know, I spent a long time at one point in my life working and learning how to lucid dream, which I don't really, it happens some now, but I've sort of become less invested in it as a practice. So it doesn't happen. It doesn't sort of, I don't think it's one of those things, at least for me, that you unlock and it stays unlocked forever. I think that life and stress and, you know, especially I have little kids, right? Lack of sleep, these things together kind of interfere with some of the ability to easily lucid dream and stuff like that. But, you know, so, but I definitely, my dream life is something that is very important, and I definitely get a lot of, inspiration and even direct messages from there. You know, I mean, I dream about people, you know, one time, you know, a friend of mine passed on and I knew it because I had dreamed about them that night before. And I was just like, oh, you know, this person's in my kitchen, but there's no way they're in my kitchen. I'm like, oh, they died. And I was like, okay, hey, what's going on? Blah, blah, blah. You know, so it's dream life is a fascinating thing for sure.
It really is. And actually, the Oracle of Initiation deck literally came out of the dream time. I was having dreams about a deck. I'd wanted to do a deck for many years, but I really didn't have the spiritual, emotional, psychological depth and integration, honestly, when I was younger, to do the deck that I really wanted to do. And then after that grand initiatory experience of my husband dying, and the vision quest that I went on and how I transformed and all of that, I was really ready to do the deck. And so dreams started coming about animals and human shape-shifting. And this is an interesting connection that you and I have. Yours is a little more earth plane connected, but the African and African-American spirits, for some reason, are very strong in this lifetime for me. I believe in past lives, so there's a really strong bleed through. And when I was on the edge of creating the Oracle deck, I was having lots of dreams also from African spirits. Other people were having dreams about Africans and African Americans getting up off of cards and moving to other cards, mm-hmm. which really prophesized the imagery in my Oracle deck, which is it's photographs that have a lot of movement and light and emanation in them. And then while I was creating the deck, the 6 years time that it took to do all of that, the predominance of folks who came through in the dream time with guidance and information about the deck were glowing African ancestors, where they were black underneath, but then they had the ash outside on their skin, and they're in the dream time, so they do look like they're lit up in a special way. But so dreams are, it's really quite amazing what they can do if you have the time and the ability to apprentice to them.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah, I mean, and the connection to the Orishas, right, you know, is it's an interesting one, because, you know, your dreams about me making an Orisha deck, I don't know how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely something that has crossed my mind. You know, I mean, I made my first deck last year, and I have a couple other things, other decks that I'm sort of working through and working on and so on, but you know, for me, the piece of the equation that becomes complicated is where does, you know, as a sort of traditional practitioner, what is it that is going to kind of come out of making something non-traditional from my traditional experiences, you know, and sort of converting this idea of you know, images into the cards. And, you know, I mean, I really like your artwork, you know, I find it fascinating. And, you know, there are a number of other decks around. There's Tarot of the Orishas. I think it's called the Afro-Brazilian Tarot. And there's one called the Lukumi Tarot. And to be honest, I don't find any of them very satisfying. And, you know, it becomes this sort of question of, what would I share and why, and what would I share that wouldn't be better suited by directing people to practice in a traditional manner, which is a question that I don't have any answers for, and I guess it's a question I have for you maybe around this. is, did you ever feel motivated to seek out traditional practitioners, or was that ever a part of your journey or even a consideration, or did spirit just direct you in the directions that it took you?
Fascinating question. I'm a person who believes that we have many, many lives and that they can bleed through into lives that we're currently in with memories and impulses and pieces of our destiny that we still have to work out. And so for most of my life, I'm German and Scandinavian in ethnicity in this lifetime. So I'm blonde. I'm very, very white. And there has always been this draw to other cultures for me that when I was younger, I really didn't have any understanding. And we're talking since I was a small child. There was this understanding of that I was kin with other people, that really in America at the times that I was growing up, there wasn't always the mixing in those ways. And so as I came more later into my life and more into it, being a spiritual seeker, these things started to show up more strongly, literally books falling off of shelves, books about traditional African healers, Nangas, Sangomas, those sorts of things. They would fall off of shelves at metaphysical bookstores for me. And strange, I'd go to get t-shirts printed and the man would start talking about Santeria and Eshu and how, you know, they had had the sacrifice on the little figure that had been sent to him. I'm at a t-shirt shop. I did have a shirt that said ancestral divination. But so for me, part of what I've looked at is this question about cultural co-opting and what can you, in this time where people are so splintered and people are, cultures are so wounded, everyone is wounded in some way or another. How do you navigate being drawn to these different cultures without feeling like you want to come in and you want to do the drumming and the dancing and the fun part, and then you leave and there's all of these other things that are happening in the culture that are coming out of the decimation of many traditional ways? And so for me, it's been an interesting dance of particularly connecting with my Norse traditions in a grounding sort of a way so that I could feel like I could go into some of these other indigenous groups carrying the mantle of my own tradition this time, where we're all pan-indigenous. We all had drums. We all had sweat lodges. We all had shamans, medicine people, whatever you want to call them. And so there's my path has been one of finding different tribes and places that I'm connected and weaving them together. And for a long time, because the Orishas came to me unbidden, I was doing some journeying and five of them came. And I'd done some studying about them, but I knew who they were when they came and they started talking to me and they told me, you know, we want to guide you and you belong to us and all these sorts of things. But I haven't been guided to practice with other earth plane people. And I don't know if that's partially because of the time that we're in and there's still a lot of cultural complexity to that. But I know that it's a real rainbow tribe who are doing Ifa and Vudan and Lakumi and all of those things. And so I just haven't been drawn to plant myself in one place. It feels like I am to weave lots of things together. And when I had those dreams about you and I doing an Orisha deck, mm-hmm. I have some massive reservation. I'm not saying that I'm going forward with it. I mean, if I literally was downloaded and told, you will be doing this, you are the carrier for it, you're going to need to figure it out, I would seriously consider it. But also there is that piece about I am not traditionally practicing. I'm very Northern European. Would I be the person to do it? But the reality is a lot of people, you don't know who the job is going to land on. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the job lands on who's listening and who's passionate and excited. And there's always been this passion for African spirituality that – that's just something that's been in my field, sometimes more painful than others, feeling separated from that. But so that's, there's a long rambling answer about that. But I think it's really complex. And I just am very conscious of not wanting to co-opt other people's cultures in this really shallow way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always one of those things, you know, because I run a store too, right? So, you know, I have people who do all sorts of practices from traditional to non-traditional who kind of come through here, right? And on the one hand, there's historical traditions, right? And on the other hand, there are people who are doing their own thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's always kind of somewhat uncomfortable at times to kind of bridge those two sides, right? You know, to kind of be, you know, on the one hand being like, wow, I've never heard of anybody doing practice X, which isn't to say that, you know, I mean, which it's indifferent to me what other people do, you know, I mean, it's their relationship to spirit, right? But on the other hand, the people who come around asking things and I'm like, really? I wouldn't even think about it that way, you know, and kind of trying to balance those two things, right? And I mean, one of the things that I think a bit is, you know, when we're talking about culture and we're talking about spirits, I wonder for many people if they miss the invitation, if they think that the invitation should be bigger or stronger or louder or something other than it is, right? You know, because I was talking to somebody the other day who, you know, years ago had been sort of, had got a reading and was told something in a traditional reading. And something came up and we were having a conversation about it. And they basically were like, well, yeah, I've just been kind of waiting for them to invite me. And I'm like, man, that was it 10 years ago. That was your invitation. Still hanging out, still waiting for you, no doubt. But that was it. You know, you're not going to ever get anything more than that or more clear than that necessarily. And I think that, you know, in shamanic practices, like my sense of what you practice, and in various other traditions, you know, because I have a background in ceremonial magic and Western mystery traditions and stuff like that. You know, we expect a certain kind of message to come through, you know, certainly, mm-hmm. especially like a lot of the kind of more new age, you know, and I mean that without any derision, right? Like the more new age people, they expect a vision, they expect to see things in their dreams, they expect something very clear. And in other traditions, the possibility of something might be, the whole invitation might be as simple as, you know, you had the possibility to get a reading at one point, and that was the invitation, you know? Mm-hmm. It's so much more, I experience it as being so much more earthbound, to borrow your word, right? Earthly, simple, super practical, and really, really just like, well, there's an opportunity there. You could do that. You take it or you don't, you know, but sort of a more extended invitation in the way that, like, you know, some of my more spiritist practices or other things where I have dreams and visions or, you know, scrying in the astral and things like that, where you have these sort of more elaborate practices. Those things don't tend to come up around my traditional practices, and in talking with my elders, they tend to, my sense is that that they just tend not to, you know. And I mean, obviously everybody's journey is different, right? But you know, it's fascinating. I think that there's it's one of those ways in which spending time with people who have huge amounts of experience and who are, you know, my elders are, you know, have 35, 45 years of initiation, right? Something like that, you know, and they grew up with it and all that kind of stuff. The way in which their understanding of it is so non-Western. And even though this sort of kind of more contemporary idea of shamanism or New Ageness or paganism or any of these kinds of things are ostensibly non-Western, the more I spend time kind of bridging between these different places, the more Western, the more I can see the inherent Western thought in and amongst those practices that confounds the issues. So again, not that I have a clear anything to say about it, but it's fascinating to me to watch and to sort of see the difference in expectation between people based on their cultural and sort of spiritual journeys as well. So
That's absolutely fascinating. When you started off on this question about missed invitations, I got bubbling about it. I thought, what a fascinating thing. And both of us are readers. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, to me, readers are the gateways to these invitations. I mean, that's part of what readings are for, and my deck is for, is what's your soul path? Why did you incarnate? What are the big things? You know, my readings don't generally tend to be, I hear other psychics say it's about paid or laid. You know, are you going to get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and how's your income? Which is very important stuff. I'm not disregarding. I love both of those things.
Of course.
But there's this question about the missed invitation. And I think one of my jokes is that you want to see God's hands come down and clap. And if you don't see God's hands clap, you've missed it. It's not real. And you were speaking about this Western perspective on spirit and on being embodied and ritual and ceremony and connection. And one of the things that I tend to think of that's been retained more indigenously in certain cultures is that there is not a separation between we're doing spiritual work now and we're living. So if you're in the kitchen and your neighbor comes over and she's had this dream about fish, you're cooking food and you sit down and you pull out the cards and the kids are running around, and it's not this rarefied sort of a thing where it's controlled. And sometimes I think Northern European folks, at least, have gotten really dry. They're not juicy. And what I say is that for some things that I'm drawn to, it's about blood and sex and being really, really alive and erotic in the largest sense. Because we've now put the erotic in, you know, want to try to make it, it's about sex. It's about being alive. It's living. And so this idea about missing the invitation and separating out, I'm wondering if there's a piece in the Western mind where it has to be so distinct because it's this separate thing, whereas it may have just flown into your life where you got song divination on the radio, where you heard a song and that was your call. When I was, what was that song? It's a Steve Miller song about drumming. And whenever I was on some of my shamanism things for some years, that song would be playing on buses, in stores. You know, it was one of the shamanism songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I did, a long time ago now, I did a retreat where I went and lived in the woods by myself for 10 days and fasted and did ceremonies and stuff like that. And at the time, my dad had lent me his car to go and do this. But it was a very old car and it needed to be started every day. He said, if you leave it for 10 days, you're going to be calling a tow truck. It's not going to be good, right? So every day I would go down, you know, walk out from where I was, you know, about 10 minutes to where the car was, and turn on the car, right? It was just like 1980 LeBaron, right? It's, you know, like already, you know, 25-year-old car, right? With only an AM stereo, right? You know? And so all it got was the oldie station. And so I would sit there and I would listen to one song. That was my one connection, right? And every day it was, you know, it became significant, right? You know, so it's a very, I get the music divination thing. It's a very fascinating, you know, kind of piece, right? So, then they would kind of, you know, I would take those songs with me because, again, they're oldies, so I probably knew most of the words to most of them anyway. And then I would take them with me throughout the day in my ceremonies and other stuff that I was doing while I was there. So,
and that's really, that's really fun. And I think sometimes that's, I know when I was really early on the path and consciously studying the path, and I went to one of the Foundation for Shamanic Studies opening classes, and this was when Michael Harner was still teaching. And so Michael Harner, the anthropologist turned shamanic person, writer, visionary, he was there. And I had somewhere gotten this vision that practitioners were to be very reserved and contained and serious and noble. And Michael Harner is a goofball. He laughs like a little kid. It's like the Dalai Lama, and he makes fun, and he's irreverent, but he's also very wise and intelligent. And it just, that opened my world up. I thought, oh my God, this doesn't have to be uptight. I feel called to this, but you know, I was going to become the most uptight German version of myself I could ever imagine. It would be horrible. And so you going and listening to the oldie station and the LeBaron, that just rules. I have this image now of you, this you know, wild green man in the woods. Yeah. And then you're going to listen. And I don't know how much oldies it was. Are we talking Rockin' Robin here or something?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're talking 70s. Like 50s and 60s.
Sweet.
Yeah,
sweet.
Definitely.
That's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the car was gold, too, which was awesome, right?
You were big pimping, brother.
Something like that. So in the woods by myself. That's about as big as it gets, but yeah. So the other thing I'm curious about, or you know, something that I'm fascinated about, is so you just ran crowdsourcing to republish your deck in a more accessible format, because the original publication is beautiful and lush and has the price tag that goes with such things,
it's
right?
An investment.
Exactly, right? And you know, not to say it's not worth it, you know, like many of these things, right? You know, I mean, I end up with a lot of hard to come by decks coming through the store. And I'm always amazed, you know. I recently had Tarot of the Crone by Ellen Lorenzi Prince. And it was the first limited edition of 100, you know, hand done, whatever. They're stunning cards, right? You know, and you know, like many of those things, they come with a bigger price tag. But when we were chatting a bit before the show, I was really enjoying this conversation we were having, and we derailed it to bring it back here, about how crowdsourcing is changing things. You know, and recently I've had a variety, pretty much every day I have invitations to some kind of crowdsourcing thing come through, and some of which I'm excited about, and some of which I wonder why they're asking me for money. But you know, so I'm curious how you see it, though. You know, what do you see about this process for you?
Well, as we were saying a little when we started chatting about this, I see it actually as this revolutionary new resource system. That it's a way that, because it's called crowdsourcing, the thought is that many hands make light work, that you have multiple people who help fund a project, anywhere from $1 to $10. The average amount that people give is between 25 to 100. And so if you have a project, instead of having to get a patron or a grant or something that's 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 from one source, you go straight to the community and you see what they want. And that's, it's also, there's a lot. To me, it's we're experimenting. We're learning how to do this. This is manifestation in a different way, more with energetics and intentions. And I don't think everybody consciously looks at it that way. Clearly, because I have such a spiritual bent, I'm going to look at it energetically and intentionally. But there is there was just a questionnaire that Tarot Professionals had on Facebook with Marcus Katz and Tali Goodwin. Can't remember the woman's name, but she had this whole series of questions for people about divination and tarot and should you buy your own deck and this whole series. And so they set it up as a questionnaire. And Tali just posted that one of the things that came out of the questionnaire was that people were so excited about access to a variety of decks because people can self-publish more easily now. And I think of in the 70s when there was the occult store that hardly anybody even went into the occult store. You know, it was like going into the back room of something, and there was 10 decks that you could get. And the climate is so different. I mean, spirituality has, everybody does yoga. I mean, I was born in the late 60s. In the 70s, it still was really pretty fringe, health food and all those sorts of things. And so it's come into the general population. So back to crowdfunding, there's really this, I feel like it's a portal, that it's this place where we can access our tribe and build tribe around our work and connect with people in this really honorable way, because it's a lot about transparency and being really honest about what your costs are and what you need. And people are doing different levels of doing that well. But it's the way that you can make your dreams come true in a way that's really sustainable for everybody. And you welcome other people into your project. It's a co-creative experience. And the exchange is not just money. And in fact, a lot of the exchange is support and people reposting and just sharing work that they love. And so I've been selling for about 4 years my deluxe limited edition decks with the big 400-page book. And those are, at this point, it's $155 in the United States for that set, shipping. And I wanted to have a more accessible version of the deck. And so I decided to do the crowdfunding. And it was as if a stallion came into me and was propelling me to do this. Because honestly, if you're going to do it well, it's an absurd amount of work. If you don't have time, I'm going to be really honest with you, don't do it. If you have lots of kids and a full-time job and you're taking care of your mother and all of these other things, which is beautiful, you're going to fry yourself or the campaign may not do well. I spent 3 months gearing up for the campaign, getting my platforms uniform and getting the video done and all those sorts of things. And it's an incredible investment of time and energy, but also 2,300 people looked at my campaign. There's 23, now people probably looked at it multiple times, but that's probably at least 1,500 people who didn't know that I existed or that my products existed before that. And there was all sorts of synchronicities with the campaign, and my campaign didn't reach its goal. And that's an interesting thing. And to me, there's the spiritual aspect of things, which is you don't know why things happen. There's this enormous trust. And then there's the human ego self. And of course, everyone has both. And so my human ego self really wanted to reach my goal of 8,888.
Of course.
I really wanted that. And then the part of me that saw this as an experiment and saw it as tribe building and putting myself out there in a way that I'd never done, which was a miracle, because I have a hermit side. I have a side of me that wants to hide in the cave, and maybe I'll shove my products out the front of the cave and you all can come and grab them. But for the most part, you know, I want to walk the hills and do my art and hide. And so, so then there's the spiritual aspect. I don't know why I didn't reach my goal. I was at 82% of the goal, which is a little odd because usually you don't, it's pretty low what comes in, or you make the goal. So mm-hmm. There's some reason that it happened that way, I believe. I don't always get to know. Mm-hmm. But it still, to me, was an incredible success because I put myself out there. And that was just a really big issue for me about willing to be seen and share my magic. And so it's all gravy at this point, but you know, there is that little tiny ego part. That's like, I put a price on my head and the price, it didn't come. And you know, which is just, you get to talk to those voices and go, okay, I hear you. I hear you. We're going to survive and it's all good.
Well, you know, I mean, it's, we can play tarot reader for a minute here with your 82%, right? Can we do that?
Yeah. Okay. I would love that. Yes, please.
So, 82% went great, right?
Yeah.
18% didn't work out.
Yeah.
Trump 18 is the moon.
Yeah. Oh.
Right?
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, especially in light of your conversation about what is out there in the world and what is kind of hidden in the cave, in the dark, at night, the shadow of the unconscious, right? Yeah, I wonder what work with the moon you might need to do in order to complete the deck, to complete your journey that's part of your healing process at this point in time.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Absolutely. And what's interesting is with the moon, one of the themes that came through when I wrote the book for the Oracle of Initiation deck was this theme of my Artemis return. And what happened during that whole 7-year vision quest was that I really returned to the land in a profound way that I hadn't experienced probably since I was a child, this really pure, wild, sovereign, free connection to the land and exploration. I'm a jolly pagan. I'm a land nut. And so the horses were the ones that carried me back there, particularly in the Southwest. But it was particularly making the painted body images in the Oracle deck that really anchored it in. And so the Artemis return theme is that there is Artemis, the wild huntress goddess, very sovereign. She's a virgin goddess, which doesn't necessarily mean she doesn't have sex, but it means she belongs to herself. She's not betrothed to a man. She's an initiator of young girls, and she's very connected to the moon and her silver bow and all of that. And the return piece is about Saturn return from astrology, where there's every almost 30 years, you have these major times in your life where you go back and you evaluate what you've been through, you see how it's working, and then you may course correct to head on to the next phase. And so 28 and a half is the first, I think 28 maybe, 28 is the first phase of the Saturn return. And so I felt that was really, even though it was 33, I was 33 years old when the major initiation tower card happened, that I was in my Saturn return of reevaluating absolutely everything that I had inherited from the culture and all of my fears and my insecurities and who I wanted to be as a woman and a person and an artist. And then filtering that through this wild, independent woman on the land who traveled by herself basically for 7 years. And so that's interesting that you would bring up the moon too with the Artemis return piece, because they're really, it's really woven together with the creation of the deck and the life that I have now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in those themes, return, right? Like, I mean, if we look at our Saturn return, basically every 28 years, right? So that means that every 7 years we hit a new square of that issue, yeah. Right?
Right.
So something's going to roll around, you know, square, opposition, square again, and then back for our second Saturn return in our, you know, just past our mid-50s, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, these themes, and I think that this is an interesting thing for me about initiation. This is an interesting thing for me about life in general, right? We never get rid of stuff entirely. These themes resurface in new levels, deeper levels, profounder levels, or perhaps they surface even just as, hey, I'm not doing that thing that I used to do.
Exactly.
But even that is a definition in opposition or in relationship to those patterns, right? And so, you know, I guess the question of, you know, these journeys, right? And for me, although the moon card doesn't really have any sort of direct correlation to Saturn, you know, especially because for such a long time I worked with the Thoth deck, right? Where card is so sort of dark and nocturnal, right? It often has a very Saturnian feel to me. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Structure building. Well, and the piece that you're talking about spiritual growth, it's an onion. We're peeling layers of an onion, and different layers emerge. And one of the other major themes that came through in the Oracle deck was rainbows in the dark. And I believe that we teach what we need to learn ourselves because we really want to anchor it in and understand it. So there's this draw to the things that we want to integrate or master in some way. And during the creation of the deck, and this is part of the connection again to the Orishas and Africans and ancient storytellers of any tradition, is, and the griots, is that, as I've had this strong draw to hip hop since I was a kid. And when I was, for years, I'd wanted to integrate it into my work somehow, but in an integrous way, not just kind of slapping it on. And when I moved to New Mexico and was, and I was about, I think, 3 years into the deck, and the whole structure of the deck had been created, all of the words and all of the realms and everything, but the artwork wasn't coming through. And I found some graffiti tunnels, which I've always loved, and they were vibrating in a different way. There was just this power in them. And I had this epiphany about tribally painting myself and going down into the tunnels and taking photos, which ended up being some of the images in the deck. And so this Rainbows in the Dark, which is the graffiti down in the tunnels, is this piece about this paradox, so many spiritual paradoxes, about the thing that breaks your heart most or is your biggest challenge or your biggest struggle has the potential to be your greatest gift in some way. And so there's that, it's like there's that rub. It's what you're talking about. Is there something alchemical that happens when there's this combustion between things that have some opposition, at least the way that the energies are on the planet at this point? Who knows what could happen in the future? But at this point, there is this. And so it's what you're talking about, I think, in some ways is taking the things that you keep bumping into, going, okay, how am I to serve you? How am I to serve myself? How am I to serve the world with this? There's something that it's an invitation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like Chiron. You familiar with Chiron?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. For those who might not be, Chiron is a centaur, was a centaur in Greek mythology. And Chiron, the centaurs were immortal. And somehow or other, Chiron got stabbed with this spear that caused a wound that could never heal, right? And so then Chiron spent the rest of his eternal life seeking healing and learning how to heal everybody else, despite never being able to actually heal this wound himself. In the mythic tarot, Chiron is on the Hierophant card, I believe, you know, as the healer. You know, and Chiron in astrology also often follows this kind of thing, right? Where Chiron is an asteroid that journeys around through the outer planets and just inside Saturn's orbit, I believe. And so it provides this connection to all those deep transformative energies and this sort of, you know, deep Saturnian force and all that kind of stuff. And I believe its return is every 50 years. So it's kind of on its own little journey. So. Mm-hmm. Cool. So I guess if people are looking for you, if people are looking to check out your deck, if people want to find out about you, where do they look for you, Melisse?
Well, I am on Facebook, and Melisse is spelled in a very creative way. I actually, one of my teachers, Beatrix Quintana, she does Tibetan numerology, and so I was wanting to move into the person that I had become, and so we did the name to be auspicious, and so it's spelled with two L's and two S's and an A-E, but Lucia is pretty straightforward. But you can find me on Facebook under Melisse Lucia. The Oracle of Initiation is also there. And then there's an Oracle of Initiation page, which is just www.oracleofinitiation.com. And those, I'm going to be at actually quite a few Tarot conferences this year. I'm really quite excited about it. I'm going to go to TarotCon in Dallas in October. And then in March of next year, there's going to be a Tarot conference called the Northwest Tarot Symposium that Devera Publishing is going to be putting on that will be in Portland, Oregon. And I'm going to speak there on crowdfunding. And then I've just signed up to go to Reader Studio, the big East Coast conference that people love. And James Wells is, you know, always represents there. So I'm going to do that next April. So I'm going to be making the rounds. So you can come meet me in person, and you can find decks. The deluxe deck is still available. There's, I think there's about 60 left of this second limited edition run. And then should be by this fall, this new tarot-sized version that I'm going to print. I decided not to print the 1,000 that I had wanted to do from the crowdfunding experience, and I'm going to print a smaller run, and they'll be tarot-sized, and they'll come in a little velvet bag, and there'll be a PDF that will accompany that instead of the box and the book at this point. And self-publishing is all really an evolution unto itself, and there's just different versions that you do of decks, and I'll probably do different versions of that deck for the rest of my life.
That's fun. You know, when I came out with my deck, Tarot Waiting to Happen, last year, and, you know, the premise was basically, so what happens just before the scenes we're accustomed to seeing, right? What takes us into that energy? And, you know, it's funny, right? Because number one, I ran what I ran, and I'm not running them again. That's when this is done, it's done, you know?
Yeah.
I definitely have some left, but, you know, I'm just like, I don't want to keep running it forever, you know?
Yeah.
But as you say, these things evolve and take on a life of their own, right? And as I was printing it, whatever, I was like, you know, I don't want a box. I mean, what are you going to do with a box? I don't store any of my decks in their boxes, unless they're decks I don't like, in which case I eventually give them away anyway, right? You know, if they stay in the box, they're doomed. They're not a part of my collection for long. So I was like, oh, you know, I want a bag or whatever. And so I reached out to a friend who sewed, and he was like, no, I'm not sewing 200 little bags, right? He's like, talk to this person instead. And then when I did, they said, oh, and did you want me to silk screen something on there? And I was like, yes, cool. Yes, I do. And, you know, we went back and forth, and anyway, it all worked out. So I got to make these little silkscreen bags that go with them that I think are way better than anything else that I would have kind of thought more formally, you know, because they're so custom, right? So, yeah.
Anyway. Oh, that's fabulous. Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, people do have opinions about those. One of my friends said the box is too linear and that she gets into her linear mind instead of her intuition. But I love products and I love to make things. And like Lisa de St. Croix's Tarot de St. Croix and Ellen Lorenzi Prince's Dark Goddess Tarot. I mean, those to me, I love that they're in a box. So I think it's all good. I like to make stuff. And
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Life is good. Divination is good.
Divination is good. Well, thank you for being on. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you. It's been delightful. Thank you. And thank you to the dream spirits who brought us together, my friend.
Absolutely.
Yay.